and welcome to this episode of the Newcastle Oral History Unit podcast. Throughout this series, we will broadcast regular episodes that feature some of the fantastic interviews that we have conducted over the last couple of years. Episodes will range from project-specific discussions to conversations with leading international oral historians about their own practice and future directions within the field. Please feel free to contact us at any time via email, where we're at oralhistory@newcastle.ac.uk, or follow us on Twitter, where we're at @NCL_oralhistory. The 5th of February 2021 marks the 40th anniversary of the start of the Lee Jeans factory occupation, led by mostly women workers in the town of Greenock. It also means that it's now been 10 years that I've been researching the occupation, on and off, because the first time I spoke about it publicly was at a dinner dance held to mark the 30th anniversary. At that time, I was working on my undergraduate dissertation and embarking on my first attempt at oral history to understand industrial dispute. 3 years later, I returned to the occupation as part of my PhD thesis. The project had grown significantly and incorporated two other factory occupations launched by Scottish women at the time, at Lovable Bra in Cumbernauld and at Plessy Capacitors in Bathgate. There has been no previous attempt to understand these occupations collectively, to examine what they can tell us about working class resistance to capital mobility and how the memories of the workers have been shaped by 4 decades of deindustrialisation. I argue that this is a significant oversight in our understandings of working class and feminine resistance to capital closure. Over the next year, I will release a new series of podcasts that focus on these disputes. The research was completed for my PhD in 2017, and I'm currently working with the material for a book being published by Liverpool University Press. The aim of the podcast, however, is to share the voices, the narratives and the memories of the women involved with little input academically from me. But by way of an introduction, I'll briefly place the occupation within the broader economic history of Scotland in the period, before then moving on to introduce the narrators who will talk about the origins of the Lee Jeans dispute 40 years ago today. While Jim Phillips, Ewan Gibbs, Valerie Wright and others have demonstrated that deindustrialisation has a longer history in Scotland, towards the late 1970s and into the early 1980s, the process was accelerating. In the first two quarters of 1979, manufacturing job losses were approximately 51,000. Throughout the first half of the 1980s, 613 manufacturing sites closed across Scotland, which meant the loss of 164,000 jobs. Inverclyde, Greenock's county and the location of the Lee Jeans occupation, had already been experiencing these issues. The decline of shipbuilding and sugar refinery and textiles had a longer history, and this resulted in the county being designated a development district as early as 1960, which meant it was a locality in which had a high rate of unemployment, and this was expected to persist more generally. 20 years on, however, there was no sign of improvement. Between 1976 and 1980, there were 4,580 redundancies in Inverclyde, which meant that by 1981, there were 18 unemployed persons for every job vacancy listed. In May of 1981, unemployment for men and women in Greenock was much higher than Scottish averages, and more significantly in the context of the Lees workers, female unemployment was at 13.3%, 50% higher than Scottish averages. It was within this context that the workers at Lees were told that their factory was closing and production would be relocated to Ireland. The Lee Jeans factory opened in Greenock in 1970 and was actually a response to the decline of the town's traditional manufacturing base. By bringing a major producer of high-end consumer goods and Lee Jeans to the town, it was hoped that it would form part of Inverclyde's new, modern economy. VF Corporation, the US-based owners of Lee Jeans, moved to Greenock upon receiving substantial public funds due to the county's designation as a development district and unemployment problems. They occupied a local authority-provided factory and received free renting rates in their first 3 years of production, with half renting rates for the following 3 years. Investment grants meant that the government paid 40% towards the cost of the plant and machinery, and the regional employment premium entitled the company to a payment of £2 per worker per week. Crucially though, there was nothing to bind the company to the town. By 1981, the factory employed 240 mostly women workers, and despite apparent evidence of high productivity and a full order book, VF announced that the plant was to close. The reason given was the recession of the early 80s and the increasing value of the pound. However, the workers would contend for the next 7 months that the company's motives were the availability of higher public grants in Ireland and the possibility of further reducing their production costs. The Lee Jeans workers were no longer required by VF and would join the growing number of redundant people in Inverclyde and across Scotland. Spoiler alert before the next few episodes, but in August 1981, the workers were vindicated, the factory was saved, and they returned to their sewing machines. In this episode, we'll hear from two of the workers involved. Later on, Margaret Brown will talk through her memories of being a teenager working in the factory when plans were made to occupy. But we begin with Helen Monaghan. Helen was in her 40s at the time of the dispute and was a shop steward and figurehead of the workers' action. While it appeared that the occupation was the spontaneous response to a sudden closure announcement, Helen begins by reflecting on the evidence that suggested to her that VF Corporation were intending to close the plant in the months leading up to the occupation beginning. I hope you enjoy.
We had a cutting room, and this was another manager that came. He'd worked in Australia, and we had a cutting room, and the next thing I got sent for to say the cutting room was getting shifted over to Ireland. And before that, VF was over in Ireland, and they asked for some of our lasses to go over there and train them. Mm-hmm. They were going to get into the jeans market, and my daughter was one of them. So 16 of the lasses went over there to train them how to make jeans. And then the cutting room was going away, and I went into him, and I says to the manager, and he tell me, I went, the cutting room's going away. I said, how does that make sense? I said, if you got to ship the jeans over here after they're cut to get sewed, is that not an extra expense? I can't see how that would pay. I kind of knew what was going on, but I was looking for an answer after him, and he went, but he left because he's seen the writing on the wall. And then there was other things, like I told you, I was the one at the finishing article, and they were letting a lot of things go, and I thought, something going on here. So I says to the lassies, there's something going on here. There were a big order to go, and they were pushing. And I says to the lassies, listen, I think we'll keep our time with that order. I think once that order goes out, we're off. And I was right, because we were negotiating a pay rise that we should have got in February. It was just your annual pay rise. And we're getting told there were no money and all sorts of excuses. And we even offered to put everything forward. We'd offer to do a 3-day, at the time it was about the value of the pound and all that. Well, if we do a 3-day week, things should pick up and my job's, at least our factory's still here and we can work. We had to put all these things in because you weren't going to give up, and obviously it was trying them. Job sharing, we offered everything, and every time, we'll put that to them, and then you'd get back, and the answer was no. So the very final thing, we had a meeting in a canteen, and I says, I think they're going to shut us up. I says, I'm going in for this last meeting. I says, so we decided that we were going to occupy the factory. So they all got chairs, and they put them in front of the door, that they would come in for the office. We barricade ourselves in, and the minute I come in, no, we had everything all planned. I says, the minute I come in and say, they said no to everything, that's us. So I come in and said no, and the next thing, we were barricaded in. We barricaded them out the office. We were barricaded in because we didn't want out, because we knew if we'd have went out, we wouldn't have got word. No, they would have just shut the place.
Aye.
So we stayed in the canteen. We still had on, we're there at 8 o'clock in the morning. And we were, then that's the night we sent, because we were all hungry, to shut the canteen as well. And the boys and Margaret Wallace went over the roof and went for fish suppers. But then one of the, I think it was Margaret, I think when she was out, she got in touch with her mammy and tell her mammy that what was happening. And mammy phoned ITV, and apparently it ended up in the news.
All right.
And so by that time then, people were coming up with blankets and flasks, and we'd only a wee hopper. They were handing them through the window, and so that kept us going that night. So we just slept, our overalls, and sat in chairs and slept till the next morning. And then the next, I thought, okay, next morning I'll talk to you. But no, they didn't. And so we thought then, we need to organise ourselves then. And then people were coming up, newspapers, and asking to see me. And I says, no, I didn't want to be in the front of a paper or anything like that. I just thought this would have went over in a few days.
Aye.
We'd given them a fright. And then I realised that, no, that wasn't going to happen. We'll need to look for support somewhere else. And then that's when we sort of come out. But little did I know it would last 7 months.
Where did the idea of a sit-in come from?
I don't know.
How did you decide on that?
Don't know. I know we banded things about, you know, what we would do. And then what happened the next day was... the next day, the manager sent for me. And I went in and he said, Eleanor, I'd appreciate it. They were all wondering about the factory flare, just to stretch your legs. And he says, I'd appreciate it, he said, if you would keep them all inside the canteen. I said, well, I would appreciate it if you would open the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
I says, because we've no had a cup of tea or anything. I says, so I'll keep them off the floor if you keep open the canteen. So he opened the canteen. That was the worst thing he could have did. Because then we organised ourselves, we were cooking everything.
Mm-hmm.
And he opened the canteen, so it was us at the canteen. Then we had somebody, I don't know, but his wife was on the other side, he was one maintenance man, and we got him to get the keys and a bar of soap, but like you see in the pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And we spoke about that at first, but he got the keys and we got them cut quickly, and then we let ourselves out and in the door.
Mm-hmm.
Then we put men on the door that they couldn't get into us, but then we could get out and in then.
Aye.
And then that's organised ourselves into two shifts.
Two shifts? How were they organised?
8 to 8 and 8 at night, 8 to 8 the next morning. We just had to sleep in the cloakroom, the offices.
Mm-hmm.
Most days slept in the cloakroom because with chairs and tables in the canteen.
Mm-hmm.
So we slept in the offices or else the cloakroom. I know I was in the cloakroom, that's where I slept.
Mm-hmm.
And we get a, you know what you get in the beach, your bed.
Aye, well, then,
because by the time the 7 months was up, they were only fit for the bin.
How were decisions made during the sitting?
We had meetings. Mm-hmm. But that, well, we organised ourselves into for by that, we had a committee.
Right.
And we'd half the committee had to go in one shift and half the committee went in the other shift.
Mm-hmm. How many were on the committee?
Two men were in it because the head mechanic was in it and the maintenance man, because they were bands that we had to depend today.
Mm-hmm.
Well, John was the head mechanic, my son was an apprentice, so they seen the oil in the machines.
Right.
Every day to keep them right, hopefully we'd get our jobs back.
Mm-hmm.
I says, we'll need to make some concessions where we give them a night off, because
mm-hmm.
it's no easy.
No.
And you could see them all tiring out, you know, and then you had to bring up, that's how we brought up bands and groups and all sorts.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I often think of him when I see him on the television, George Galloway.
Oh, aye.
He was up and he brought us doing, I mind it was a film, Norma Ray, she was, he fought in America.
Mm-hmm.
For her rights, she worked in a cotton mill factory, and he was doing, and because my son was running about with a big PLO scarf, George had given him. But he was good, he come a lot, and he brought bands doing for, he belonged to Dundee.
Mm.
He brought a lot of them doing for the, they were on the council up there, so he brought them doing. To see, you know, come down every so often.
Mm-hmm.
Even that kept you going when the lassies seen that there were bands paying attention and wanting to help you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kept them going. But they often say to me to this day, even the ones knew it's over 50, they'll say, see when we think that, Ellen. In fact, Catherine Robinson says to me one day, see when I think that, Ellen. She says, your head must have been sore with us. She says, we were young and we could have laughed. Mm-hmm. You couldn't, you'd a home and family and all that responsibility, and we weren't even thinking of that at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I says, I know, I could have bloody killed you at times.
So what was, why was it so important for you to keep that factory in Greenock?
Because there weren't another, there were no jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and as I said, in that factory in particular, I mean, no, but there were 3 wages out of my house.
Aye.
There were 4 wages out of that house, I was telling you. It was all 2 and 3 sisters, and it was all families with 2 or 3 in the factory.
Mm-hmm.
So that was wages lost, and there were no other jobs going. And we thought, no. And what made us so mad as well was, we were going to tell how great a worker we were.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly, then I get the gisto at tea. What happened was, over in Northern Ireland, it was, they were in a worse state than us job-wise. So they were offering them big incentives to come over there. So when they came into Greenock, they got offered rent-free,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of other, they got money for their machinery.
Mm-hmm.
So that was them going to Northern Ireland, was offering them rent-free. And they got it for 10 years, so the 10 years was up. That's how I was 10 years in it. The 10 years was up. So what they were going to do was take all that machinery over to Northern Ireland. And it was the taxpayers here that paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept asking and asking and asking for somebody that was in the council at that particular time to stand up and be counted, and nobody did it.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody did it, and then things get that bad that, obviously, they were a photo of me in the tilly every time I'm thinking it to. Jimmy Boyd was a provost at the time, and somebody went to the door and they came in, and I looked around, and it was Jimmy Boyd. And there were a photo of me in the tilly going, what are you want? Because he's the one that I was asking. This was about 14 weeks into it. This is the man I was asking for. To stand up and say, aye, they did get grants, aye, they did get the machinery,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't do it. But then, obviously, he was shamed into having to come up,
mm-hmm.
because they were other ones that thought, oh, they're going to be away after a couple of weeks. Do you know what I mean? And they'll need to face it. But when he realised he had to face it, that's when he come up.
So when you started the sitting, at least, had you heard then what had been done before?
No.
No?
The only thing that I knew was, and I didn't, I was a bit younger then, I don't suppose I paid attention to it, because I always did pay attention to politics, was the Upper Clyde mine.
Mm-hmm.
Theirs was a working.
Mm-hmm.
That was all, I followed it.
You can really hear the anger and the incredulity rising in Helen's voice when she talks about the reasons she felt the factory was closing, before levelling off again when the subject changes. This interview was conducted 35 years after the sit-in, but the memory of injustice continued to provoke a strong emotional response. Helen also talked there about her age and her experience on reflecting during the dispute. Next, Margaret Brown discusses her memories as a young woman who was not involved in the organisation of the action, about what she remembers of the first stages of the sit-in. Now, I should say, there's no need to check your equipment. Margaret's budgie does make an appearance throughout this clip.
Well, we went into the canteen that night to have the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And it, obviously, you know what it was for. It was because they were going to shut down, and as we thought, we were just going in for a meeting to find out what was happening and what was going to go on. But as it turns out, it never happened like that. And I can't remember exactly how it came about, but we were given a couple of options. And one of the options was, why don't we just sit in,
mm-hmm.
occupy the factory? And they had a vote. And then everybody that had put their hand up, she's right, that's it. And then they were just kind of sent to different places. You do this, you do that, you do that. And that was us in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it happened before we all actually realised, wait a minute, what have we just kind of said to you?
Aye.
But it just carried on from there. you know, then it was a matter of trying to get everybody to be able to phone so that they could let on. And at the time, my mother was in hospital. So the likes of that, we get using the phone first to explain. And I remember I was to go for the shopping for the house that night. But a lot of folk had just come to work just for their normal, what they usually do.
Aye.
And then there wasn't enough money, they never had enough money to get their tea sort of thing. So I remember having to dish out my mum's money to get everybody, so when they went for the fish suppers, everybody was getting something to eat.
Mm-hmm.
I did get it back. You know, I did get it back. And that was how it started. And then, as we were all in the factory, and it was a, I remember it was a very, very uncomfortable night because you were sitting at the tables or you were lying on the floor and there was nothing. You know, that was it, there was nothing.
Aye.
And folk were coming up and we had one wee door and they were passing sandwiches through, you know, as the word get out. But that first night was terrible. I don't think anybody expected it to be what it was, but it was really terrible. So it was. And then we started to get organised. Helen and Ian and all the rest of them organised it, and then we split into the two shifts, 8 to 8. I think it was a couple of days before we eventually got home. But carried on from there, the shifts worked, we all got jobs to do, you clean the floors, you do the cooking. You know, everybody had something to do. So it was. Then it carried on, the talks, the union was up, and then it just sort of snowballed. It was in all the papers, it was all these people coming up, the shipyards. I mean, the shipyards were brilliant. Not just the shipyards, but the shipyards were really, you know, they were there fully supportive, and you know, and then it started, we started getting sent out to different places, and then people were coming up. Other than Margaret Wallace, who entertained us brilliantly, we called them the Dirty Dozen eventually.
Right.
So we did. They used to put on the rainway shows, Dancing with the Mops, and Margaret's a good singer, so she was singing. Kathy Robertson was singing, and then folks started to come up, you know, to give us shows and things like that. After we'd managed to get the keys and get our own door sort of thing. And it just, it was just like part of, that became a routine. You know, you knew you were in a sitting, but it was like going to work every day.
Aye.
If you were in for 8 to 8, or from 8 at night to 8 in the morning, that just, then we started getting the beds, you know, put together, and the blankets and the quilts. And during the day we just sat after we'd done what we were supposed to do, and I don't know how many people I taught to knit. We sat knitting or playing cards or, you know, or talking to the people that come up to see us or things like that. And that was just it. It just became part of life. So it did.
Why do you think he's decided to sit in rather than take redundancy?
Well, I don't think at the time, well, maybe some did, I don't know, but a lot didn't realise just what a sitting meant. I think maybe they thought a sitting, and it might only be a couple of days, it might only be the one day, it might be, I don't think folk fully realised what a sitting was.
Yeah.
But we knew the factory had orders, and we knew that we could get the orders out, and the material, everything was there, so we wanted to keep our jobs. So we did. We didn't want them. Basically, they'd come in, they'd got all the grants, they'd done everything, and as soon as they had to start paying their way, they wanted to up stakes and go somewhere else, that they would do the same thing all over again.
Yeah.
So I think that was it. We wanted our jobs. We knew we were capable of keeping the factory going. And the longer it went on, the more we began to understand exactly what we were doing.
Aye.
You know, this was something, we had started it, we were going to stay there to the end. Granted, a few folk left for different reasons, you know, maybe somebody get a job, or maybe somebody was ill, or, you know, but the biggest bulk, although they had left, they still were supportive of what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it, we stayed right through to the end. And I know they say it was like 7.5 months, but it was nearly 9 months before everything gets sort of, you know, sorted out.
Aye.
And we were able to go back to work.
Mm-hmm.
The occupation would continue until August 1981. Over the next few months, I'll be producing regular podcasts featuring interviews with these workers about different aspects of the dispute. These will include the support of other workers, of the people of Greenock, the disappointing role of their own trade union, and the importance of deindustrialisation in shaping their memories of the action. I look forward to speaking to you then.